The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to a very strange Space Show time on Friday night. We hardly ever do that. Sometimes, I think it's been years since we've done a Friday night Space Show. But it's strange, but then strange things happen when Dr. Brandenburg is our guest. So this is absolutely perfect to have a Friday night unusual show and an unusual topic with our beloved Dr. B, who is back with us. First of all, welcome. I am your host, David Livingston, and thank you very much for listening this Friday evening. We definitely want you to call in and talk with us, specifically talking with Dr. Brandenburg, not me. 1-866-687-7223. And the email is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. But the phone number is the preferred way, of course. You can also post on our blog, and I've been posting messages on our blog for Dr. Brandenburg, so you'll see some things already on the blog as he has been responding to Mr. Fincannon's earlier post. But to post on our blog, it's all the way over to the far right to the upcoming show menu on our website, thespaceshow.com. We're the first show listed. Click on that link and open that page, and comments and questions are down at the bottom. As soon as you post your comment or question, I'll get a copy of it and I can bring it up on air. Remember, you do not, let me repeat, do not have to be logged in to discuss, to post on the blog. You can do so as a guest. So we appreciate that. This is a full-length Space Show program. And then another announcement is open lines on Sunday, 12 p.m. California time. And we definitely want to hear from you on open lines. There's a lot of suggestions that I'm going to be throwing out there for discussion. And, of course, you may have your own discussion ideas. Going into the following week, we have a Space Show on Tuesday, and then we're silent until Sunday as I'm going to Los Angeles to be part of a panel Thursday night at Griffith Observatory. And Rod Pyle is on it, and another chap. And we're going to be talking about Apollo, and then we're going to take a break. And then we're going to be talking about what's happening and what's realistic about space now, post-Apollo, as we're moving up on the 50th anniversary of Apollo. I will be back, and we will have a Space Show program on Sunday with Rand Simberg and Bill Simon. This is our annual Evola Terra show. Unfortunately, we could not do it on Saturday, which is July 20th, so we're going to do it on July 21st. So Rand and Bill will be with us Sunday, July 21st at noon. So we hope everybody stays tuned, and we have one show Tuesday evening, and then we're back again on Sunday. Again, the toll-free preferred number for tonight, 1-866-687-7223, and that line is available right now. On our website, thespaceshow.com, our detailed website newsletter is there over on the right side. Everything we do is archived. There's a store if you want Space Show t-shirts and logo wear. Just click on any of the photos of Pepper listening to the Space Show, and you'll go right to our Space Show store. Upper left menu has a Listen Live button or Listen Now. And this tells you how to listen to live shows, MP3s that are compressed on our website as archives, and then podcasts, including Alexa. If you have any questions about archive, live listening, or podcasting, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. do also remember we are a listener-supported program, and we are a 501c3 nonprofit. So your financial support keeps the Space Show going and allows us to have great guests like we have tonight with Dr. John Brandenburg. And there's a PayPal button on our homepage over on the right side for those of you that can make contributions electronically with your credit card. For those of you who would like to use the mail and a check the old-fashioned way, that information is provided on that PayPal button on the right side of our website as well. We wouldn't be doing this show without your support, so it is very, very important to us. We're coming into the second half of the year, and your support is extremely critical. So if you like what you're hearing and you like what we're doing, please do support us. For more information on our 501c3, go to onegiantleapfoundation.org. You can also become part of our advisory board, and that information is on the onegiantleapfoundation.org website. And if you have any questions about that or anything else, again, do email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. In addition to individual support, we do have sponsors, and those sponsors get that banner ad going across the homepage that you see. You can change that banner ad any time. I hope you click on it from time to time. Our sponsors are always changing their content underneath that banner, so there's always something new there. As this is a full-length Space Show program, I do want to read our sponsor messages. For the first segment, Northrop Grumman is with us. They're a leading global security company providing innovative systems, products, and solutions to government and commercial customers worldwide, offering an extraordinary portfolio of capabilities and technologies for applications from undersea to outer space, including cyberspace. And in addition, Moonwords is a sponsor. What if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon, and they based their decisions only on technical and economic merit? Moonwords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit Moonwords.com to download an early draft demo of the town and to fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. The Space Foundation sponsors us. Their 36th symposium is actually just around the corner. It'll be here before you know it, in April, in Colorado Springs at the Broadmoor. And this is an event and a conference like none other. And if you've never attended a symposium, you need to do it at least one time. But it's international. Networking is at a very, very high level. And you'll really appreciate having gone to it. And there'll be more information about it as we continue into the year and get closer to that particular event. And AIAA is our sponsor. So remember, the American Institute of Astronautics and Aeronautics is the world's largest aerospace professional society. And they have around 30,000 individual members. They represent close to 100 countries and 100 corporate members. They have an incredible peer-reviewed library that you can access. And they have 5 great events and then a lot of smaller events during the year. You can get all of their information at AIAA.org. You do not have to be an engineer to be a member. I'm a non-engineering member. So check them out. They're a great organization, AIAA. And that brings me to our program tonight with Dr. John Brandenburg, who, as I said, we like to refer to as Dr. B, and he is back with us. He's a theoretical plasma physicist, and he has his B.A. in physics with a math minor from Southern Oregon University. He has an M.S. And a Ph.D. in plasma physics from UC Davis. That was in 1981. And he has worked at a lot of different places, including Lawrence Livermore, and he's been involved in the nuclear side of space, and he writes science fiction, and we've had him on for almost all of his science fiction books. He writes science fiction under a different name, Victor Norgaard, and last time he was on, he said he was looking to turn some of his sci-fi books into a movie, and He was moving to Southern California to get right into the swing of things to do that. We're going to find out how that went. I hear him laughing, but I don't know if that's well, I learned a lot, kind of laugh, or it's
that kind of laugh.
And the last I talked to him, he was working with Dr. Woodward on mock thrusters. So it's an honor and a pleasure to have Dr. Brandenburg with us. He also is the, are you the father of the idea that an ancient civilization on Mars was destroyed by something akin to a gigantic nuclear explosion?
Yes, I am.
So you're the daddy on that theory.
I'm the daddy of that idea.
Is there any more research or data that is available to shed lights on this? And I heard you on a two-hour podcast a couple of months ago and heard you mention a Xenon 129 meteor, that I had never heard of.
In the posting that I gave you, you should have access to. As I've delved more deeply into this matter, what astounded me was that the community that looked at the isotopes of Mars, most of them had a day job that was working with nuclear weapons effects. And so they would have immediately seen that Mars was looked like it had a nuclear weapon signature. What happened is that people were trying to figure out how the solar system formed. And the best guess now is that there was a supernova in this neighborhood. Some people place it right where the sun is. That's just probably a very simplistic attitude. By the way, I found out that just because the supernova occurred here, the remnant, you know, like the neutron star that would form, doesn't necessarily stay here. It's often these supernova are asymmetric, and they basically give it a big rocket boost off in some other direction. And so they have several candidates for the supernova as the remnants of the supernova that formed this solar system and a lot of other solar systems around us, like Alpha Centauri. But if you look at the primordial meteorites, these are not meteorites from Mars. These are essentially the cosmic dust that the solar system formed out of, that was left over from this supernova, mixed with organic material like tar. And it formed what are called carbonaceous chondrites. And one of the most famous of these is called Allende, because it fell near a village called Allende in Mexico in 1968. And if you look at the most high temperature part of the dust, it would have condensed, you know, earliest out of the solar nebula, it carries a characteristic xenon signature that looks just like Mars.
Well,
this meteorite is not from Mars. This is considered to be a primordial meteorite from the earliest day that formed in the earliest moments of the solar system.
So what does that tell us?
Well, it tells us that supernova processes, when our solar system formed, it wouldn't have passed OSHA regulations. For one thing, it was all radioactive because it had been a part of a supernova explosion. And supernova explosions don't spread a uniform cloud. They spread, different parts of the supernova, like the very core, actually have different signatures than other places. And there's a process that goes on in the core of the supernova when it explodes called R process. It's R for rapid. You can look it up on Wikipedia. And it means intense high-energy neutron bombardment of elements. And that's what also happens in a hydrogen bomb. In fact, they understood the physics of R process, like the discovery of Einsteinium was made at the nuclear weapons tests, especially Mike, the original hydrogen bomb test. They discovered Einsteinium and also a rare isotope called plutonium-244. It's the most long-lived plutonium. But anyway, it captured, this primordial dust captured the very early xenon from the supernova, and it looks just like the Mars atmosphere, and as you can see from the posting. And they've done simulations now of kind of the elements in a supernova core and what how they are transmuted by neutron bombardment in rapid succession. And so they, I have all the references there.
So
go check them out.
So are you now saying that it wasn't a nuke on Mars, but a supernova?
No, no. There's only two known possibilities for to explain the Martian xenon distribution. One is a supernova occurred on Mars. We know that's not true. There wouldn't be a Mars. In fact, there wouldn't be a solar system if that had happened. The other alternative is a supernova-like explosion, only on a much smaller scale, and that would have been a large nuclear weapon. There are other ways of getting a iodine-129 peak, as we find on Mars, but if you look up in the literature, they'll just call it a mystery, because if it was due to the decay of iodine-129 in the soil after the... It basically requires the Mars atmosphere being removed and a very, very thin atmosphere, so it gets this predominant 129 addition from decay of iodine in the soil. And then that's what then remains. But it also would have to decay plutonium-244, and which has a similar half-life, and that gives a lot of iodine-132, which is gives the normal iodine spectrum, which you find on every other planet and the comets and everything. So the iodine, the xenon mass spectrum on Mars is conceded to be a mystery. So I have offered a solution to the mystery, and I offer evidence, you know, from the meteorite Allende, which everybody knows about, well known in the literature, and of course, that implies that extraterrestrial intelligence was active in this area, and it was active in the worst possible way. And people are not prepared for that. They are still not prepared for the idea that we are not alone in the universe. And as the that the universe, that intelligence, as well as planets, you know, we know that the stuff of life, the organic materials, and planets, for those organic materials to gather, especially water and other things, to create habitats for life, we know those are common in the universe now. But people will not accept that life and life's ultimate adaptation to the universe, intelligence, is also common. But we're having to find that out. It's being the circumstances we face now are that through multiple avenues, we are now being basically told that we are not alone in the universe. In fact, as the heroine in my novel about the UFO cover-up says, not only are we not alone in the universe, we're not even lonely.
but you know, I think, well, if we assume you're correct, and I hear from people all the time who think you're a Looney Tune fringe.
Well, that's okay.
You know, and you're not correct, but if we assume that there, I think people are more ready to accept E.T. on the Star Trek model than on we're mean SOBs that we're going to blow your ass up with giant nuclear bombs.
The Klingons were in the Star Trek universe, including the Romulans.
Right, and you know.
In addition to the Vulcans and all these, my favorites. My favorite Star Trek episode on the, you know, the original series was Journey to Babel, where they were having to play host to a whole bunch of delegations.
Yeah, I remember that.
And it was a great, one, and you could see that the Vulcans actually considered the humans, at least were willing to concede that things could be solved logically, where some of these other races were just.
But see, there's no counterbalancing to your theory. You know, there's no Federation trying to establish global peace, harmony, and kumbaya throughout the universe.
No, there isn't.
You've just got this evil, we're going to blow you up, and who can contemplate blowing up a whole planet,
well,
you know?
Well, it was like the evil empire in Star Wars.
Well, but I'm just saying, you're...
Somebody asked me why Mars, and I quoted Governor Tarkin. I said, Tatooine is too remote to be a good example to the surrounding planet.
So, people, you know, as long as they're sort of halfway sane, know that was a story in science fiction. You're proposing the evil as real, and I think that's a hard act to accept.
Well, I thought long and hard about whether I should say it, whether I should write the book. I did it because I was afraid that we were entering into a new Cold War scenario where I grew up with mutual assured destruction.
Right.
I did not want to. I wanted my children and grandchildren. I have two beautiful granddaughters. I wanted them to be free of that. And our original investigation was done in the shadow of nuclear winter on Mars, you know, which started with a dust storm on Mars, and also Able Archer, which was a war exercise by NATO that brought us as close to nuclear war as the Cuban Missile Crisis, except it was all secret at the time. It was in November of 1983. And so I just, I'm taking one for the team. So what?
You got a couple of blog posts before the show started. So one was very, very long. I'm not going to read it on the air. But listeners, you can read it from James Fincannon. And Dr. B posted a response.
Yes, and I'm grateful for Mr. Fincannon. You know, he forced me to do a lot of homework, and that's always good for a scientist.
Well, there's a PDF document that's rather long and detailed that he has posted in response to Mr. Fincannon. But the other comment he made, which was very short, was he wondered about who did the remote viewing of Mars to go see what went on Mars 100 million years ago whenever it was. So
it has been told to me in the last few months by people who I used to work with in Washington, D.C., who were in the intelligence community, that all the time when they were drinking their beer and nodding and smiling while I was talking about all this Mars stuff, they were going to meetings at other intelligence agencies and at the Pentagon. The government, in about the mid-'80s, when I had just arrived in Washington, D.C., the U.S. government was obsessed with Mars and the intelligence community, defense and intelligence community, and they thoroughly investigated it. This is what I was told recently. And one of the things, you know, how many tools could they apply? Well, they had photo interpretation. They got the people who found the Cuban missile during the Cuban Missile Crisis, people like that, they brought them in. And they also brought in remote viewers because they had no access to Mars. I was also, and you'll love this, I was also told that in the latter part of the Viking missions, they lowered the orbits of both the Viking A and B orbiters so they could take much higher resolution pictures. And those pictures were never released to the public.
Did you see them?
I actually tried to look up some of those late, and all they show is craters. That's all they show.
So, Well, first of all, let's go to remote viewing since Mr. Pincannon asked you about it. And you posted an article from a defense publication about remote viewing Mars, and that is on the blog, listener.
And that's about all I can say.
So what do they say about it? I took the basic remote viewing course with Paul Smith way back when, and I didn't think there was much to it. Maybe that's because I wasn't going to be a great remote viewer. But
it's a little bit spooky, and
it's on the woo-woo side.
I guess you could say that. I will just say that the defense community itself was uncomfortable with remote viewing, but it apparently, the story I heard was that it had been right often enough that they couldn't abandon it. They would get clues from remote viewing, and then they would check them out using other national technical means, and they would be verified. So it was viewed as, yes, it's like a crazy old uncle, and you keep locked in the attic, but every once in a while he pushes a piece of paper underneath the door, and you read it, and it's true.
So did you see the bomb going off?
No, I didn't.
No, but what I mean is, did they see enough through remote viewing to confirm there were nuclear explosions on Mars?
No, they never would talk about that. They would never talk about it.
So no outcome.
The nuclear experts I showed the data to just immediately said, "Oh, that's nuclear signature, absolutely." And the original reason I even got interested in it was because I was working at Sandia National Labs. I had spent more than 9 years working in nuclear weapons labs. And when I was at Sandia Labs doing the original Mars investigation, a fellow commented, I'd shown him the xenon abundance spectrum on versus atomic number, and he said, "Oh, somebody nuked him." He just said it immediately. Then, in fact, after he said it, he excused himself, and which meant he'd spoken out of turn. He'd said something classified in an unclassified setting, and we all knew that sometimes that happened. And we were at the library at Sandia.
So what do you need to have or to study or to research to advance your hypothesis one way or the other?
Well, they've landed the InSight lander on Mars.
Right.
And it's, I believe it was launched from Vandenberg.
Right.
Which, I was part of the Clementine mission. It was also launched from Vandenberg. And that means it's a military...
But we went through the reason why they launched it there. Do you remember what the official story?
Oh, yes, they have a rather elaborate reason for they wanted to give the workers at Cape Canaveral a rest. And
yeah, they had
like
labor problems.
But it also means it.
You didn't buy it, is what you're saying.
No, I'm not buying that. That's very lame. I believe they launched it because it had a classified payload. And what they're doing is they've probably got a very sensitive NASA gamma ray spectrometer, and they're looking for plutonium-244, which is a signature isotope from a nuclear explosion.
Would it still exist 100 million years later?
Yeah. It's got its half-life, I believe, is like 80 million years. I'm sorry, I don't have that number. Right.
So does
plutonium-244? If the explosion occurred, if the explosions occurred, say, a quarter billion years ago, 250 million years ago,
uh-huh,
then there would still be detectable amounts of plutonium-244 in the soil.
Would it be there in the soil naturally?
No.
So it has to come from a bomb?
It has to come from a recent bomb in geologic time.
And so you think
it was plutonium-244 in the soil from the original supernova that formed the solar system.
Uh-huh.
But that decayed, it was 4.5 billion years ago. So after a few billion years, there's none of it left. But if you set off a big nuke, then you create more plutonium-244. And if it was set off in recent geologic time, which is like a quarter of a billion years,
so why
then there would be some there.
Why would they keep that search or that research classified? What's classified about that?
Looking for hydrogen bomb residues on Mars?
Yeah, I mean...
That's because that sounds like Brandenburg's scenario, and we don't want to talk about it.
But, I mean, there's no national security threat there, is there?
Yes, there's an implied one.
From what? The group that nuked Mars here and nuke us?
It basically... part of the national security interest is public morale. And if they believe the idea of a planet-destroying nuclear weapon being deployed by somebody else other than us, this is a very frightening possibility, and they don't want to entertain discussion of that right now. They may even acknowledge that Mars was like Earth, that it finally developed. Not only life, but a humanoid civilization. They may concede that at some point in the near future. But they will talk. They don't want to talk about the nuke part.
So you're to advance your hypothesis...
Unless the defense budget is up for a vote, a tight vote, then they will want to talk about it.
So to advance your hypothesis, you need information on a suspected classified mission that may not have even happened. Right.
Of course, Dave.
What else do you need? What else do you need?
When you're in this kind of territory, that's what you're talking about, and it's difficult territory for a scientist.
What else do you need other than insight data?
All of the photo data is out there. I think that's compelling myself. And... you know, if you have a big face, what looks like a big car face with some erosion on it, it would, of course, have to be eroded because it's archaeology. And 20 kilometers away is what looks like a pyramid. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out.
Well, except they refute that stuff. They don't, you know, there's all the...
they haven't refuted it.
They're all the scientists and people...
They poo-pooed it.
Yeah, they say it's not true. There's no face. It's just, you know, your imagination and your... So,
and they say there's no pyramid next to it either.
Correct. So I'm just saying that's totally debunked by everybody but you and Richard Hoagland.
Well,
I'm trying to find...
Well, Dave, you know, what can I say?
I'm trying to find...
I call them as I see them.
I'm trying to find a path to...
No, you're not going to find a path. The only path is in the hands of the government. They are the ones that hold the card.
So if Elon Musk sends a private mission to Mars, is there anything he could do on a private mission to Mars?
No, they're going to pull him aside. The dead civilization on Mars is not going to be officially acknowledged until the government is damn good and ready.
So you think a private mission... would be influenced to not get into this.
Yes. You don't realize it, but you need a license to go to Mars.
No, I understand the process. You need a launch license and all sorts of stuff.
You need a launch license, and there's the...
what about a Chinese...
Planetary Protection Program, they call it.
What about a Chinese Mars mission? That they're not subject to the same constraints.
They haven't done it.
Well, they haven't gotten to Mars yet.
They haven't gotten to Mars. India went to Mars.
Right.
And just before they launched to Mars, I had a good friend who was of Indian ancestry, who was a scientist, call me up and basically squeeze me like a grape for everything I knew about the dead civilization on Mars. I could not figure out what had prompted it. And then suddenly... they launched a probe to Mars, and I realized he was probably trying to find out if there was any last pieces of data that I knew that I'd maybe not put in the book.
So we
on Mars.
So we're stuck. We can't find out if you're on the mark or a crackpot, can we?
Well, there's a fine line between genius and madness, Dave. You know that as well as I do.
Yeah, so I'm just saying we can't find out which side of the line you're on because
we can't
get the information.
Well, I said, like, I laid my cards down and we'll just see what happens. I made my choices and I knew what I was getting into when I did it.
The Mars 2020 mission, do you... know anything about that one? Do you think that's got anything on
it? That's going to land at a nice river delta.
Right, a big crater.
I have a mainstream kind of science. It's a kind of a large, elaborate hypothesis called a synthesis.
Uh-huh.
Where you take a whole bunch of data. It's called the New Mars Synthesis, and I presented it. You can Google it. And I said, for one thing, that Mars had liquid water on its surface for almost all of its geologic history, and now people have verified that. So, Mars science, in terms of Mars being Earth-like in the past, is catching, that's all the New Mars Synthesis is that Mars had Mars was Earth-like for most of its planetary history geologically, and people are starting to come around to that.
You have an email
sure.
from and listeners. I know nobody's at work, so please use the phone tonight. 1-866-687-7223. Todd is in San Diego, and he says. Dr. B, I'm just curious to know if there isn't any source out there that wouldn't be able to have more information. For example, what about the atmospheric scientists that study the Mars atmosphere with all the satellites that have landed on Mars and are orbiting Mars? Isn't there something in their research that would talk about the distribution of xenon 129?
Their models for how to get the xenon 129 without a big nuclear blast, most of them are considered inadequate. They require Mars to have had a thin atmosphere for most of its history, and we know from the water channels and the old ocean basin that Mars has had a thick atmosphere. So. If you just focus in myopically on the isotope distribution, you can come up with some model that'll do it. But it's at variance with the rest of the Mars data. It requires Mars to have had a very thin atmosphere for most of its history, and we know that's not true. There wouldn't be any big water. There wouldn't be water channels all over Mars. The water would have evaporated immediately into vapor.
You have a call. Are you ready for this?
Very good.
Let's see who our caller is. Hold on. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show with Dr. Brandenburg. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is John in Fort Worth.
Hi, John.
Hey,
yeah.
John.
I was wanting to ask you something about what your perception of the ongoing work with Dr. Woodward's Mach thruster is.
I think that it's an inspired project. It's being funded by the NIAC, NASA Advanced Concepts, and I'm not at liberty to talk about the real details of the data we're getting, but it looks like James Woodward came up with a new way to propel spacecraft. And we're trying to amplify the effect and demonstrate it finally with a small satellite eventually.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's based on the idea of the Mach's principle that local inertia is basically determined by faraway masses. That space-time is essentially anchored by faraway masses, like the Sun and the Moon and Mars and the rest of the galaxy, so that's what makes objects resist changes in their motion locally. The theory looks reasonable mathematically, as far as I'm concerned. But he says, John, nobody cares about the theory. They just want to see experimental results.
Well, that's true. I mean, if you get the thing to work, I guess that's...
They want to see the thing to work. They want Jetsons flying cars. And I understand that completely. So I have concentrated on just helping the experiment.
Is there a timeline for scaling up the results and the effect?
Well, we've already scaled up the effects a little bit, so I won't really say anything more. We're just working as fast as we can.
Yeah.
I believe the funding is, you know, for another year at present levels, and then there's the possibility of getting a follow-on if they think we've made sufficient progress.
Do you read the newsletter that Dr. Woodward sends out to about 10 million people?
Oh, yeah.
So, Jack Sarfati published on Woodward's newsletter all of this information about M-Drive being
good
real. Do you know Jack?
Yes, I know Jack.
Okay, so I only
Jack
know...
Jack is a brilliant guy.
I only know who he is. He may be a little...
He's got a real personality, though.
Yeah,
I'll just leave it at that. I call him Wolfman Jack.
So he published a thing on Woodward's newsletter about proving M-Drive. So what do you know about progress or research or Dr. Sarfati on M-Drive?
I know Jack has a rather elaborate theory involving metamaterials, and he believes he can, the speed of light is obviously a big
issue with him, yeah.
Yeah, big part of the equation, of Einstein's equation for general relativity, and he believes that we can actually change that effective speed of light, which is, it's basically electromagnetically changing space-time, and we're using a metamaterial with very strange electromagnetic properties. So I regard it as a very interesting idea. I have yet to hear of a demonstration of this effect, unfortunately. So, whereas James Woodward has a experiment, and I sit in the room and... work with them on building things to support this experiment. It's very simple. It's very straightforward. And there's really no other explanation that there seems to be producing a force out of nothing but the reaction of local space-time to mass fluctuations and created in the device. So, Jack Sarfati is a brilliant guy. He may have a really good idea, but... until he can have some kind of results like James Woodward. James Woodward responded because he had experimental results as well as a theory to explain them. Or the theory, suggested this would be possible, and then he had experimental results that seemed to agree with the theory. That's why he was funded.
Did he get his larger office back, or is he still in the smaller office?
He's still in the smaller office. But he says it's perfect. It's not a very big experiment, so it's perfectly...
No, I know. I've been there several times, as you know.
Absolutely, yes. I remember.
And John has been there, but John was in the larger office.
Yeah. I would like to bring something up here that it takes a couple of steps to get to where I'm going, but it might be interesting to you. First thing is, you familiar... I got some charts, and I sent back copies again the other day to David there. That Hal Puthoff has put out, he had a lecture somewhere too about a presentation about a piece of metamaterial, which allegedly was recovered from a UFO. But I don't know how he did it.
I don't think that's what they call it. They just say it was recovered material from a foreign vehicle.
From a foreign vehicle, that's right. Very foreign vehicle. Very foreign.
How foreign?
And the point is, okay, and here's the thing. And they found out it has some kind of a resonance thing at some frequency of 5 terahertz, okay?
Sure.
Now, Woodward's theory is also frequency dependent. Most of your experiments are running in the kilohertz range, I believe.
Right, they are.
Well, suppose, could it be, just the possibility, if you had a craft that was made out of this exotic metamaterial in its hull, and you stimulate it at this much more massive thing, it's a squared function, that would give a much more massive force.
Oh, I know. I know.
So it's, could Woodward's theory be the explanation for how these things are propelled, these very foreign objects, let's just call it?
I haven't spoken with Hal. I spoke with Hal like 20 years ago where he was mentioning these things. So they have been looking at this for a long time, and this is now that he's talked about it openly, I don't feel bound by his he wanted me to kind of shush about it, and so I did, and so. Hal's a really smart guy.
Yeah.
And he was heavily involved in remote viewing, and of Mars in particular, apparently, I've heard. And he also works on unified field theory like I do, particularly trying to unify gravity and electromagnetism so you would be able to control space-time with strong electromagnetic fields directly. And so we're both kind of moving in the same orbit and trying to make progress for this country's advancement and defense.
Yeah. Well, I just think that when I first ran into this on a YouTube broadcast with, all people, Tom DeLong mentioned something about this.
Tom DeLong.
And I grabbed Woodward's
book. Rockstar.
Didn't that say frequency dependent? And I equation 3.10.
It's you would expect it would be frequency dependent. And,
right, and I said, whoa, gee, squared frequency. And I said, if you go from kilohertz to terahertz, oh, my goodness, that would be a lot of
frequency. So, John Brandenburg, a lot of listeners don't have the physics background of you or John Hunt.
Yes.
So tell the listeners, or explain to the listeners, what John Hunt is talking about with the terahertz frequency and what he means with all of it. Let them in on what you're talking about.
Well, I the difference between infrared and ultraviolet is frequency. And, of course, one intense infrared radiation makes you feel hot on a hot summer day. But intense ultraviolet radiation gives you a sunburn even if you're snow skiing. So frequency is very important. And one of Einstein's the original Nobel Prize for Einstein was that he showed that the frequency of the light would affect the photoelectric effect. That if it was below a certain frequency, if it was red light, you would get no photoelectric effect. But if you had blue light on the same metal, it would start emitting electrons. And so that's a frequency dependence. So frequency is very important in the quantum mechanical, quantum electrodynamics, QED, which is the most accurate physical theory we have. You can get answers out to 8 decimal places if you ask the right question. Of course, being it's physics, I like to say that physics is like an apartment with holes in the walls, and you cover the people hang paintings over the holes in the walls, so it looks like everything is fine, but the wind blows, suddenly the pictures fall off the wall, and looks like a beautiful apartment until the wind blows and the wind, and the pictures start falling off the walls, and you recognize there are big holes in the walls. So you've got things like QED, quantum electrodynamics, which was formulated by Feynman, Richard Feynman. And this has all of these marvelous problems that are solved out to 8 decimal places. But then you've got other problems like why does the vacuum weigh nothing when, according to QED, they call this the most embarrassing number in physics. Every cubic centimeter should weigh as much as the observable universe. And, of course, that's nonsense. And so we have a theory that looks like it can provide very, very precise answers to certain problems, but other problems like what happens to Schrodinger's cat, it can't answer.
So how does a material vibrate at terahertz? Yeah.
Oh, terahertz is a pretty low frequency compared to molecular oscillations. Visible light is, John Hunt can help us. Red light?
Some kind of microwave stimulation, I would think, is how it would be done.
Trillion their horn.
We don't hear it, so.
Oh, good.
Like a trillion times as opposed to, 10 to the 12th, right, versus...
Yeah, so it's a
trillion... third.
Microwave frequencies, heat water for our coffee. And, but if you go a trillion times higher than that, actually it's 1,000, it's gigahertz, and then there's 10 to the 12th, that's terahertz, so that's 1,000 times microwave frequencies. And then you're getting into almost infrared light. The difference between microwaves and infrared light, long-wave infrared light. Frequency changes things. I mean, if you look at the electromagnetic spectrum, it goes all the way from radio waves up to gamma rays, and there's a really tiny portion that we can see with our eyes. The rainbow of light, of colors, it is basically what passes through liquid water. And so frequency is very important, and we would expect any theory that would perhaps be able to unify gravity and electromagnetism, for instance, to be have a strong frequency dependence. Now, there's a problem, by the way. It's a very interesting physics problem. Let's say you build a Jetsons flying car, for instance, and the bottom of it has a big antenna to create electromagnetic fields so that it basically negates gravity. But the problem is that even though you're negating gravity, this is a new feature of electromagnetic theory, but it doesn't take away what is presently known about electromagnetic theory. So if you try to run that Jetson flying car at too high a frequency, then you're just a radio station. And almost all of your energy just goes out as radio waves, and none of it hangs around to change gravity. And that means that people, let's say someone had figured out how to change gravity with electromagnetic fields, that would tend to work at what we would consider low frequencies, like in the kilohertz range or below. Because if they try to go higher frequencies, then they end up dissipating all their energy into radio waves. They become a radio station or a television station. And not enough field energy hangs around for them to affect space-time.
Okay.
The other problem with, by the way, with riding around with an electromagnetic magic carpet is anyone who knows in the right frequency band to put up a receiver can hear you coming. This happened in Vietnam. The communists, the Americans used helicopters very heavily, and the communists simply put up what we call infrasound sensors so they could detect the very low frequency emitted by their helicopter rotors, so they could hear the helicopters coming before the human beings could, thus taking away any element of surprise. And not only that, if you have like an electromagnetic magic carpet, a Jetson's flying car, let's say, and then somebody's in a bad mood, they could aim, you know, this requires kind of a very nonlinear kind of interaction between gravity, electromagnetism, and the structure of space-time and gravity fields. If somebody was ill-disposed towards you, they could focus intense pulses of microwaves and disrupt that very sensitive nonlinear effect.
So they could crash the car.
Make you crash.
Gee, could that explain something? I don't know.
Well, it might explain a few things.
What might it
raise many other questions.
Well, that's fun.
which I prefer to treat in science fiction. Let me put it that way.
Put it that way, yes. Well, I just thought I'd bring that up. I just saw a relationship there between the put off thing and these extremely foreign objects. And I said,
I noticed.
Yeah.
I noticed Hal is on Woodward's mailing list.
Yes, he is.
Along with every other probably famous scientist in the world.
Hal is a really smart guy, and we like to hear his advice.
Do you hear from him from time to time?
From time to time, yes.
I'm going to contact him out of the blue and see if he'll come on the space show.
Well, that would be interesting.
I have been following him from the first time I learned about remote viewing with Art Bell.
He preceded me by his career.
Well, he's older than you.
By a couple decades, but
yeah, he's old.
I spontaneously ended up being interested in the same things as him. Unified field theory and extraterrestrial intelligence. And so that was nice. And he liked my novel, by the way. He liked my science fiction.
Ah, good for him.
And he's Russian-American. He called it the War and Peace. The UFO genre.
If I use your name in my email, will it keep me from getting him on the show, or might it help?
I think it will help, but I don't know.
He'll know who you are.
Yes, and by the way, I am presenting my own unified field theory at the big theoretical physics meeting called the American Physical Society Division of Particles and Fields. It has all the stuff, all the particle physicists and string theorists and beyond the standard model people show up, and I got a paper accepted, so I'm going to be going there spreading my stuff.
This is on the blog, Liz.
I consider myself unique. I'm the only person who has an accurate formula from my unified field theory that gives a value for big G, the Newton gravitation constant, and also the mass of the proton. Directly out of the vacuum within, with no free, there's no diddle factors in either formula, and yet both are accurate within about a part per thousand.
Listeners, I've posted a link and
yes, so you can see
on the blog.
The abstract.
Yeah, so it's on the blog already.
If anybody else had gotten Big G, you'd have heard about it. because one of the big criticisms of string theory has been that it doesn't produce any numbers. It doesn't explain anything, you know, in terms of numerics, and it doesn't predict any, like, new particles that they can measure in the, you know, Large Hadron Collider or anything like that. So, what Miller said, it is a boil on the backside of physics and a religious cult.
That is a notable result. I agree with that. That's a
thing. Wow. John Hunton.
Well, I think so. In fact, I think, John, I remember you actually checking the formula.
Yeah, I did. Well, I saw
it. And
that,
it turns out,
really,
you know, it's good within a part per thousand.
Yep.
And nobody else has that, came up with that thing except me. And if they had, you'd have heard about it. So anyway, so I'm going to this big conference.
Where is the conference and when is it?
Oh, it's in Boston. I'll be presenting my paper August 1st.
Oh, so it's pretty soon coming up.
Right. It's pretty soon. And
John Hunt, anything else from you, or I'll clear the line?
Let's see. One last thing. I hope I can introduce this without getting too long. Have you seen the TV series on the History Channel, Unidentified, by any chance?
Oh, yes, I have.
Okay, the last show.
And I've spoken to Luis Elizondo several times at conferences.
Yeah. You saw
he seems to me one of the same kind of people I used to work with in D.C.
He says when they launch it, they can't launch an air-to-air missile at them because they'll turn it back on you. It reminds me of something in your science fiction book.
Oh, yes. There's a
I was thinking of you when he said that.
Both the Americans and the Russians finally say, if you really want to kill a UFO, you got to get close and just use a cannon.
So
that's what he said. That's what I'm getting at. I was just there going, what?
And then in one of my, in the sequel to the collapse of the UFO cover-up, there's the UFO war. It was called To Rule the Night, and they hold up in a big attack on this one UFO base they find in Africa so they can launch this supposedly super sophisticated intelligent drone at it.
Yeah.
And the hero is one of the main characters. One of the heroes is in command, and he tells this computer geek with a ponytail who's in the middle of Africa, and he says, if your drone is truly intelligent, you should explain to it that if it deviates from its flight plan, we will shoot it down. You know, if it's smart enough to make its own life decisions, then it should know it's going to be destroyed. And of course they launch it, and the aliens break into supposedly its unbreakable code and turn it back on the American military within 10 seconds. And they have to shoot down their own drone.
Do you have Elizondo's contact information?
Myself, no.
Okay.
My contacts were basically, I was sat on a panel with him and at the MUFON conference, I think it was last year, and then I just chatted with him at another conference in Huntsville.
Okay, John Hunt, anything else? We'll see if anyone else wants to call us.
Okay, I'll get off. But
thank you, John, for your sage comments.
Thank you. Listeners, John Hunt has... I cleared the line. It is 866-687-7223. Since we're beyond the point and not taking a break, let me at least pause for a minute here, and I'll tell you who the second, I was going to say second semester, but the second part of our show sponsors are. So we have the Space Development Network. Would you like to see space settlement occur within your lifetime? The Space Development Network is an online organization that allows you to join together with others to advance the plan for space development. They look for people with a wide variety of interest and skill. It's a free network to join. So check it out, and that is at developspace.info. And let us know if you do check it out and what you do. The National Space Society is a sponsor. They have great events like the ISDC, which I just attended and we have talked extensively about on the Space Show. They also have space settlement conferences in Los Angeles, and they do a lot of white papers. Their website, space.nss.org. And then Celestis, and Celestis is still the only truly and pioneer memorial spaceflight service around. And they can fulfill your dream of spaceflight by flying either your DNA or a small cremated portion of your remains into Earth orbit. They can fly you to the moon, to deep space, or on a suborbital flight like the Mercury missions did. There's nothing more emotionally moving than watching a loved one launched into space on a Celestis Memorial spaceflight. So you can check it out. Family and friends are moved too. I've been present at a couple of them, and I can confirm all of this. If for some reason the launch fails, they give you a second. Well, they give your relatives. You're gone. Your ashes or DNA get a second launch, and hopefully the second one does better than the first one. So you can get more
information. Rocket science, you know.
That's right. You can get a lot more information by going to Celestis.com. And then the Integrated Space Plan sponsors us, and they're currently doing a Kickstarter, everybody. They want to upgrade the space plan for 2019 and create a Race to the Moon poster. The Race to the Moon poster will show the milestones accomplished by the U.S. and the Soviet Union during their famous race to the moon. There have been tremendous changes in the space landscape since the last space plan was developed. The last edition had no mention of the SpaceX BFR or Starship, as they had not been analyzed when the space plan was finalized. Your support is needed to create an updated space plan for 2019, and our future is brighter than ever. Visit the campaign on Kickstarter and support it. Share it on social media or both. On Kickstarter, you can search for the Integrated Space Plan. You can also find the address on their website, or you can check it out on the banner ad on the website, my website. And you'll notice that there is a space plan guest interview option as one of their benefits. So that may interest some of you. Check it out. And we thank all of our sponsors very, very much. John, before we go on to some other topics,
sure.
Do you have another sci-fi book in the works?
Yes, I do, but I'd rather, it's early enough, I'd rather, I will simply say that this is one of the sci-fi novels I actually began in the 70s, when I was originally a graduate student at Lawrence Livermore National Lab. I was quite young and naive at the time, and I made up for that by just being very agreeable and trying to be very conventional. One of the interesting things that happened was we were all taken aside as graduate students and told, if anyone asks you if warp drive is possible, like in Star Trek, your answer is no.
Why?
We were part of the disinformation brigade, of course, after they invented wormholes, then warp drive did become possible, but that wasn't till many years later. But one of the things that was going on when I arrived at Lawrence Livermore National Lab as a young graduate student in 1975 was they had the first good chips, and they were building the first really good computers using, you know, a bunch of chips. And it was amazing, and the computing science people, we shared our building, half of it was physics and half of it was computing science. And the computing science students were all very enthusiastic, and they would come running up to me. I seemed to have the right face for people to run up to me breathlessly, and they would tell me that the human race would be obsolete by 1980 and extinct by the year 2000 due to AI. AI was going to take over the world.
Looks like they missed it a little bit, didn't it?
Well, my response, and I actually had this guy, my response was, what are these white circles around your nostrils? And they said, oh, John, that's cocaine. It's a new drug, and it's not addicting. Now, that, all that talk about replacing the human race with a bunch of silicon life ended up producing the movie Terminator as a reaction.
Okay.
So the, well, because the whole of California and, you know, early Silicon Valley and everything like that was just buzzing with this idea of replacing the human race with this new ubermensch made of silicon. And now they've gone better. They don't talk about replacing the human race. They talk about giving people eternal life by having them upload their consciousness into a bunch of computers. And this, this in my view, is worse. It's, you know, promising people that if they surrender themselves to this new computer overmensch, that it'll give them eternal life when, of course, no computer is going to care about the human race after it gets power. And it would consider it only a minor nuisance. So my next novel is about AI.
Okay.
The singularity.
When are we? When can we expect it?
Oh, depends on my, you know, how my work schedule, the projects I'm working on. But sometime in the next couple of years.
Are your two leading female characters part of the new novel?
Sure. They're too much too valuable. And they one of the developments of the far future, you know, in the science fiction trilogy, they basically end the UFO cover up and it starts a interstellar war. And then the human race very doggedly and ferociously manages to survive this war by invading the moon and then finally Mars and driving the Greys out of the solar system. And the Greys have a lot of other enemies, so other ETs pitch in and it becomes a general kind of war in the neighborhood. But so this picks up in the future when, like, 25 years in the future when their children are grown. And but there's been a marvelous new invention called buffered hormone therapy.
What does that do?
Also known as B-Hot in the novel, that enables people to recently, you know, it stops aging. So the women are just as lovely as ever. And so it's a bright future, and cancer is cured in the future. So one of the women gets diagnosed with heaven help us breast cancer, but instead of having a mastectomy, she just goes and gets a big shot, and can't sit down very well for a week, and that's that.
So when is your book, do you think, going to be available? What's your timeline?
It should be a couple years from now. I'm writing it, but it's basically I'm very much I feel very much I'm addressing a real concern of people. If Elon Musk and Bill Gates and Stephen Hawking all say that, you know, basically if you don't handle AI right, you're summoning forth a demon. By the way, it doesn't help that in the nomenclature of the AI community, they use the word demon to describe artificial intelligence or basically background algorithms that kind of bind the store in a computer. So so anyway, I hope people will find the book interesting.
What happened to your quest to turn your trilogy into a movie?
Oh, well, that's ongoing. And I'm I left Wisconsin to do physics in the starry realms of Southern California. That's not just Hollywood, but also, you know, the Mach effect, astrophysics, and things like that. So I'm working in the starry realms, and I've actually had several conversations about making Morningstar Pass, the collapse of the UFO cover-up, into a movie. But they're so far just discussions. And I have a script. And I'm just waiting. You have to wait till the money. Several planets have to align for a movie to be made. One has to be that the suits decide that the screenplay fits something that the public would want to see. You know, they're looking for a movie that's a blockbuster.
Right.
And so they have to decide that the collapse of the UFO cover-up, followed by an attempted coup d'etat by the secret government that's been in bed with the aliens, that the public is, you know, would find that interesting and compelling. And also, of course, the money has to be there. The money. Nothing proceeds unless somebody with a bag of money decides to back it. And that's an interesting one, and I've been instructed on what features the screenplay has to have in order for money to be forthcoming. So that's good. I'm making progress.
What are your thoughts, and have you actually done any serious investigation, or you just follow the news stories and you watch, you know, Unidentified? But what's your take on the Navy and the F-18 Hornet testifying in Tic Tac?
To be frank, when I worked in Washington, D.C., I spent from 1985 through 2001, basically up till 9/11 in Washington, D.C., before moving to Florida to work at Kennedy Space Center. And the places I worked, especially the last place I worked, which was a very highly intelligence-oriented job doing scientific analysis, discussion of UFOs, of aliens, things like that, was so common. It was just every, you know, conversations around the water cooler and in the hall before and after meetings, it would always come up.
Did they believe in them, or they just think it's crap?
Oh, they spoke of it as if it was factual, all real.
Do you know where, from where?
No, there was very little specific information. It was basically, you could kind of summarize it all by just saying, we're not alone in the universe. We're not even lonely. Many species visit here.
Well, wait.
Most of the species are friendly.
How can we not tell that? How can we not know that?
Well, some of them are not very friendly, unfortunately.
Well, but I mean, how do we not know that they're visiting? I mean, other than some farmer saying he sees lights in the sky, or now we're hearing Navy pilots say that.
Well, I was not read into any of those programs. In fact, if I had been, I wouldn't really. I decided when I was leaving, I mentioned to my superiors that I wanted to write science fiction, and I thought I wanted to write something about ufology. And they said, "Oh, John, that would be fun. Why don't you write it as science fiction, and we'll read it." and I've since caught up with some of these people who read my novel, and especially the first one, and they really liked it.
Well, what do you?
One of them even said to me, "How did you know so much stuff?" And I said, "I just guessed. I just filled in the dots, you know." If I didn't have a dot, I just created one and connected it.
So what is your take on Tic Tac, Alessandro, and all these people to the Stars Academy in this? What is this stuff?
I think we are seeing disclosure. And the disclosure is basically that we're not alone in the universe.
Well, then why don't they just admit it?
This and has known it for a long time.
So why don't they just admit it? Why is it a guessing game? Even with Alessandro, it's a guessing game.
The story's a little bit more complicated than that. There's some details. Then you ask the government, how long have you known this? Oh, that's an interesting question, they'll say. Or I asked one department one defense official, people have wondered if perhaps this disclosure is motivated by some crisis in outer space that's classified. And he just stared at me for probably 30 seconds. And said to me, that's a very interesting theory, John. And you can conclude from exchange whatever you like.
So these objects that the Navy is photographing, you think they're real?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And do they come from us? Do we have any capabilities like that in physics?
I don't think they're us. If they were ours, we're spending a lot of money on jet fighters that we are actually very obsolete.
Yeah, obviously.
And if they're not our, if they're Russian or Chinese, then we would all be speaking Chinese or Russian by now.
What about them being holographic image projections? Is there any technology that would allow that?
Not any technology that I'm aware of. I think it would be simpler just to unify gravity and electromagnetism so you could basically make vehicles that would fly like that and do right angle turns.
Simple,
like
but that. No one knows how to unify that.
Well, I'm going to... I've made progress.
I know,
and
but...
I'm going to the conference and present my stuff.
How can you test your gem theory?
Well, it predicts a... particle at 22 MeV that they will find. It'll be very rare, but they should find it if they look hard enough. They've already found one that possibly is 16 MeV. Now, an electron is half an MeV in rest mass energy.
Uh-huh.
And a proton is 1 billion electron volts, 1 billion EV, a GeV, rather. So this is... kind of a geometric mean of the mass of the proton and the mass of the electron. It's in a mass region that no particle is known to exist in. And so I predicted this as part of my theory, and I believe it will be found to verify the theory.
So is anyone searching for it?
Yes, people are. They're not searching for my particle in particular, but they're searching for particles in that mass range. And they've concluded that they're very rare, which means they have to have a whole bunch of electron beams collide with themselves for, you know, months and months to get enough events, possibly to claim discovery. There's astrophysical evidence for the 22 MeV particle, it's called the Morning Star particle, and so we'll see. So I've made a prediction. The other prediction is that the part of the cosmic background radiation is actually due to electrons and protons like hydrogen popping into existence in the space. That the proton is and the electron are both absolutely stable, but space-time, the vacuum, is itself unstable. And this isn't just my theory that predicts this, but other theories also. So I'm making predictions that can be verified or refuted. And I like to, when... one of the great advances of quantum mechanics was the Bohr model of Niels Bohr. And that basically did not predict. It predicted some new behaviors, but mostly it just explained what they were seeing in the light from the hydrogen atom that would come out in these distinct lines, and it predicted the wavelengths of the lines with great accuracy. The Bohr model is extremely accurate, even though it's very simple, and people could criticize it by saying it was conceptually simplistic. I mean, we know the electrons don't follow orbits like planets around the sun. They're a bunch of fuzz jumping around, you know, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. But as it turns out, it gives the same answer when you do the exact quantum mechanics. It gives the same answer as if it was a planet moving around the sun, the proton. So I call my model a kind of a Bohr model of unification. It's perhaps simplistic conceptually, but it does give good numbers. It gives big G, it gives the mass of the proton out of the vacuum, and it also gives the masses of the pions and the W and Z particles of the weak force. So I'm doing well, I think.
You have another email.
All right.
Larry says, hi, I don't want to tell you what school I attend studying physics, but it's in Southern California. And, John, what I want to know is, does your work and association with fringe and what some people say pseudoscience hurt you in your mainstream science, like being able to present at this conference you're talking about? Does being labeled pseudo on the web or fringe, like the face on Mars, hurt you?
It does in some quarters. But what has happened is that, for one thing, they have had a remarkable set of failures, theoretically, in the last couple decades. They came up with the grand unification theory. They predicted protons would decay, for instance, and then they found that that just wasn't true. Then they also had supersymmetry, which predicted that every
that failed too.
Fermion would have a boson partner, and they found that that has not, the predicted particles have simply not appeared. Then they have, of course, string theory, and it has failed to give any prediction of any new particle or any new effect that they can measure. And so one of the things that is helping me is a sense of desperation. And so they're more willing to entertain new ideas that are a little strange, especially if they're proposed by new people who are a little strange. The other thing that is happening is that more and more people, because of the Tic Tac and the Nimitz incidents, are now willing to concede that we are not alone in the universe, and it's unrealistic to imagine that. It's unrealistic to imagine that we wouldn't find remains of a dead civilization, perhaps on a nearby heavenly body that may have had an Earth-like past. That used to be kind of just, we'd have to go 100 light years to find a planet with a dead civilization on it. Like Mars, like the planet that looked like Mars that had archaeology, eroded archaeology on it. Now, people are more open to the idea that life and intelligence are rather common in the universe, and therefore we wouldn't have to travel so far to find it.
Avi Loeb at Harvard shocked him when he said that fast-moving object, Oumuamua, that they named it, might have come from an advanced life civilization.
And his
And he's not someone you want to mess with, I guess. He's been on the show before.
He said he had been threatened with firing.
I did not hear that.
He said, I look forward to being fired because then if I'm not the head of the department, since I wouldn't lose, I have tenure, I can't be fired from
right.
the position. He said, I'll have more time to do science rather than worry about who gets.
He was a great guest on the show, and he is very outspoken about this as a possibility. And so is I've done shows with Paul Davies, and he's over in Arizona. And I think he's a little more tempered than Avi Loeb. But
Avi Loeb has been really hammered by some people, and so he's got to have a personality of a rhinoceros.
He's incredible. He was an amazing guest on the show. I'm going to invite him back.
Had him on there.
Yeah, and
I have great respect for the man, and he, just like I did, I called him as I see him.
I could get him back on the show.
As he saw it, and I think he's.
I'm sure he would return to the show. I'm waiting for the next fast-moving object.
thing sped up as it passed the Earth.
I know.
And not only that, it apparently was launched in such a way as to have the absolute average velocity of the background, meaning its origin was disguised. Whatever star it came from, they changed its velocity so it exactly matched the absolute average of all the motions of the stars around us. So, in other words, you can't figure out which star it actually came from.
Interesting.
And, so he said it was almost done stealthily. So these are signs of intelligence, and not necessarily friendly either.
You wonder why they would be so attacking of Avi Loeb for saying something like that or talking about it.
I was at a conference where Chris McKay was presenting the work on the Mars meteorites, finding bio.
Uh-huh.
signatures in them, and he was attacked from every corner of the auditorium. And he told me afterwards, he says, I can understand their criticisms. I don't understand their anger, he says. And all I can say is the same mindset in the human race that burned Giordano Bruno at the stake is still alive and well. They don't want anyone upsetting the psychological apple cart that the human race
is
riding on now.
Who is they?
They is mainstream science, I'm sorry to say. There's a saying that goes that any new result in science will be opposed with a fury that is directly proportional to its importance. So if you go, Planck said, science advances by funerals, he says. Isn't that terrible? He's a conservative Prussian, scientist, and he says, nobody changes their mind. They die or retire, and a new generation replaces them. He had a pretty dim, cynical view of the human race. And I sincerely wanted to help lessen the dangers of nuclear war on Earth. That's why I got involved in the Mars research in the first place.
So,
and that's why I published a book on it, because I sensed that those terrible days returning with the rise of China as a superpower.
So do you think you succeeded, or now that you've got rogues with nukes like Iran and North Korea, are you still worried? Is your worry schedule gone down?
I'll tell you that I believe my book was widely read in certain circles. on both sides of the Pacific, and everyone realizes there's no safety net.
This is your death on Mars.
Blow up human civilization. No one's going to stop that from happening.
This was your book, Death on Mars, right?
Death on Mars, yes. And like I said, I wrote it because I sensed there was a deepening a mounting danger of thermonuclear war between the United States and China. And I wanted to do something about that to preserve the future for my children, three beautiful children, and I have two grandchildren. And I didn't want them having growing up with nuclear war-like nightmares like I did.
Did you send it to Iran?
No. But I do have it on good authority that the Ayatollah Rafsanjani has received a copy and has read it.
What should we have talked about tonight that we have not talked about yet?
We should talk about the fact that theoretical physics is presently in like a caravan stranded in the desert. As I said, the grand unified theory, the GUT, it predicted the proton would decay. And that theory failed. They had an enormous million tons of water vessel sitting down at the bottom of a salt mine, and finally it lit up one night, and they thought they had a proton decay, and it was instead a supernova. It was the Magellan, it was the 1987 supernova in one of the Magellanic clouds, which shows that Mother Nature is a prankster at heart. She knew these people were waiting for the strain, waiting in some park for the night call of some strange night bird, and she then set off a cherry bomb in the parking lot.
Do you know the theoretical physicist Sheldon Cooper?
No.
So he had been struggling for years because he had been working on string theory, and he realized he's wasted his time. And he wants a new career, and they won't let him have a new career because he's been funded to work on string theory.
And they poured an enormous amount of money
wait a minute. This was one of the storylines from The Big Bang Theory, and Sheldon Cooper was their theoretical physicist. So he was trying supersymmetry, and he realized that was bogus, and he's wasted his time with string theory, and he goes to Caltech, and they won't let him have another career because all of his funding grants are on string theory, and they can't.
Well, that's true.
We're laughing about it, but it's a really mirror image of what you're saying as reality.
Well, I was part of the fusion energy exercise, the effort, and that sort of was successful, but they found out the 14 MeV neutrons released by fusion energy tear all the structure apart. So you have to replace the steel in the tokamak once a year, which, means it's not very practical.
Right.
And that's terrible. And so Sheldon Cooper, he's a character in Big Bang.
And the other one, who's a physicist, Leonard Hofstadter, they keep saying, like, his girlfriend Penny, who's supposed to be the bimbo, but she's smarter than all of them.
Yeah.
She says, "So what's new today in physics?" And he just looks at her and says, "New? Nothing ever happens new in physics."
Yeah. Well, there's a great quote from Feynman when he gave his Nobel Prize acceptance speech. He said, well, all of the physicists, get their Nobel Prizes and they become famous and they establish their careers and then they become professors. And they basically teach the students the same methods that they applied to get their, to make
right.
a mark. And so these are become the fashionable methods to try. And Feynman spoke to that problem. He says, He says, where are the new... He says, if the new advances in physics actually lie in the fashionable direction, that's good. But suppose they don't. He says, you know, we've trained all these students to do these fashionable approaches, but they're looking in the wrong direction. And he says, you know, he says, who will find them? And you have to have somebody like an Einstein who, you know, instead of fighting with his department chairman and worrying about tenure and stuff like that, he was sitting in a patent office.
He's outside the system.
Yes, he was outside the system. And he made his miracle year where he published his three articles, one on relativity, one on molecular statistics, and the other on the photoelectric effect. And if he'd been sitting in a at a college as a young professor worrying about tenure and stuff like this, he probably would have never been able to create those things.
A lesson for those people in school today and younger in their careers.
And he continually, he didn't just buck current fashion when he did his original miracle year, and of course then he did relativity. He did a lot of other, he invented, you know, the theory of the laser.
Right.
Yes. Did all these wonderful things. But he finally, you know, was trying to do the unified field theory, and people, you know, like Oppenheimer, who was his boss at the Princeton Institute for Advanced Study, were just really mean to him. imagine criticizing Einstein for being crazy. That's what Oppenheimer did. He said, Einstein, he's cuckoo. Cloud cuckoo land, he says. And so I think it's time for a revolution in physics, and I'm going to go try and do it.
Anything else, then? Any concluding message for listeners?
There's one really interesting development. There's... All I can say is a rumor. I invented the microwave electrothermal thruster using water as propellant.
Uh-huh.
Water has the advantage of the rocket fuel. It's not a rare inert gas. It's not explosive. If you drop it off, if it rolls off the tabletop, it won't explode like hydrazine. It's not carcinogenic or very toxic. And you can actually drink it in an emergency.
So you invented this?
I invented it, yeah.
What do you call it?
My name's on the patent. Just look up meth thruster and fuel thereof.
What did you call it?
It's an expired patent now.
What did you call it, though?
The MET thruster.
No, but you said water. What was it?
Oh, it's the water-fueled MET thruster.
Okay.
And the patent describes it as meth microwave electrothermal thruster and fuel thereof. So I was the inventor of it.
Okay.
And I've heard that it's flying successfully.
Where?
They didn't tell me. But what it is that was one of my great inventions, and now it's flying in space, supposedly. And people are suddenly very interested in it because the patent expired, for one thing, so now it's up for grabs.
Yeah, so now you don't have to be rewarded for your work.
That's right. They don't even have to give me respect.
Absolutely.
So I'm kind of the Rodney Dangerfield of physics now. And, you know, but I knew that there would be blowback when I did the Mars discovery. And it's just a... If I Google myself, first thing that comes up is Rational Wiki, which labels me a woo peddler.
Well,
and also they say, and this is demonstrably false, and I'm going to get my pound of flesh out of them eventually. As soon as I get enough money to hire a lawyer, my parents joined a Pentecostal church when I was young, and I was the oldest son, so I joined with them. And so that was my early 20s. Instead of dropping acid, I was dropping Jesus. And since then, I've, you know, just become a Presbyterian, or now I'm just an Episcopalian. And I'm still religious, but I'm just an Episcopalian for the last 40 years. But they, you know, they portray me as a complete nut. And like I said, I'm going to get my pound of flesh out of them.
So who? Wait a minute. Who portrays you as a complete nut?
Oh, Rational Wiki.
Rational who?
Wiki.
I'm missing.
Google John E. Brandenburg, and they'll pop right up.
Rational who?
Rational Wiki. It's a bunch of people with. I like to imagine them as a bunch of people wearing all ski masks.
Uh huh.
And so they said, Brandenburg is a woo peddler. That's okay. I will get the last laugh in this.
Okay.
And but it's just part of anyone trying to do something really radically new. Just like Avi Loeb. You get the flak. Flak bursts suddenly appear around you. They do. Oh, and the other thing I want to point out is my father's war diaries have been published.
Okay.
It's Letters from Bud. And my father joined the Army Air Force on the day of Pearl Harbor. They took 2 years, though. They were so swamped with recruits, they basically gave him a uniform and sent him back to college. So then 2 years later, they called him up. And he got there just before D-Day as part of he was a navigator on a B-24 bomber. They shot down 80% of his squadron.
Wow.
Just a miracle that I'm even having this conversation with you. And so he described his survival as just due to dumb luck. His pilot, though, was this strong as an ox Jewish guy from Brooklyn, who was always determined to bring them home. And but he and the co-pilot did not get along. The co-pilot was this redneck from Missouri. And at one point, in this they were flying through all this flak, and one of the planes, four planes away in the formation, blew up, just, you know, took a direct hit.
Uh-huh.
And the pilot and co-pilot's reaction to this, my father is sitting in this little kind of office, tracking landmarks so they can find their way home if they get separated from the squadron. Suddenly the co-pilot says to the pilot, "Why are we bombing the Germans? Did the Germans bomb Pearl Harbor?" And the pilot got so angry with him. The pilot was, his family was from Poland. They were Jewish. And so they got in this big obscenity Latin argument, and my father had to go out and mediate it. And when they got back to the base, the pilot and co-pilot put on boxing gloves and got in the ring and pounded on each other for 10 minutes.
Well, who won? So,
unfortunately, well, it was a draw, but the Jewish guy from Brooklyn, he was kind of a stocky guy, but he had short arms, so the redneck from Missouri had the reach on him.
Had the reach on him.
But anyway, it's the portrayal of what it was like to be there for kind of the last year of the war in Europe. And finally, you know, they were there for, they took off the morning of Normandy. The Normandy invasion, and
right.
It was so cloudy they couldn't see where they didn't know where the bombs. So they just flew way inland. They guided by radar and then dropped their bombs far away from the beaches because they didn't want to hit our own troops. And but as the war went on, then they were bombing the German synthetic oil plants. As the war went on, gradually, you know, they could just say, gee, we're flying over France and nobody shoots at us anymore. You know, because finally Paris had fallen to the, had been liberated.
Had been liberated, right.
So it's just a story of the war during a particularly dramatic period, and what it was like being in England. You know, and they flew 30 missions.
All right.
So anyway, that book is out called Letters from Bud.
Okay, and we're pushing 2 hours, so I'm gonna. I'm gonna bring us to a. To a halt, and we'll have to wait.
It's always such a pleasure to be on your show.
We'll have to wait for new physics advancements for your next show.
Hey, absolutely. Well, I got Big G, and nobody else does.
And is that recognized in the physics community?
They know about it.
Do they give you credit, or
like a fart in a church service right now? Who's Brandenburg? Who the hell is Brandenburg, and who the hell does he think he is?
Well, I still come across people when your name comes up, and they call you pseudoscientist.
Well,
you're.
I will get the last laugh in this all, Dave. I assure you.
Well, I hope so.
I've already been told that, you know, the investigation, the open public investigation I was part of.
Uh huh.
Was just the tip of an iceberg of a massive effort in the intelligence community to find out what had happened on Mars. So, as far as I'm concerned, if a bunch of know-nothings out there think I'm a pseudoscientist, fine. I'm just doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
I think ET will come down and they'll be looking for you, their buddy, and you know they'll show everyone that
the same people will be saying, "Oh, I knew Brandenburg was right all along."
Or they'll call you a traitor, one of the two.
Well, they'll take.
John, are you still in Orange County?
Yep.
Okay.
Right now, I'm about 200 feet outside of Fullerton in a place called Brea, which is very pleasant.
Yeah, so you are where you were when we were.
Yep.
When I was there. Okay. Okay, well, I hope to see. I am going to be in L.A. next week, but not for very long. I'm going to be speaking at Griffith on Thursday as part of their Apollo thing.
Yeah, I may be actually someplace running the meth thruster on water.
Okay. Well, hopefully I'll get down on another visit, and I, you know, look forward to seeing you and seeing Heidi and Jim as well, too.
I just warn you that I may be off someplace else.
Yeah, on a
commitment.
On your Jetson electromagnetic carpet someplace.
Right, my electromagnetic flying carpet.
Okay, give my regards to Jim and to Heidi when you see them, please.
I sure will.
And I'll email you when this is uploaded and archived early in the morning.
Excellent.
Thank you very much. And listeners, thank you for your emails.
It's a pleasure and an honor to be on your show.
Thanks. And listeners, thanks for emails and your phone call. And remember, open lines on Sunday. Everybody have a great weekend. Goodbye from John, David, and the Space Show.
Great.